why, I don't know, since it is largely in the context of a heterosexual notion of aesthetics that this has come about. And thus we come to an attempt to render real, again in the context of the women's movement, I believe, the principle of mephexis, which is classically regarded as a preliminary stage to mimesis. As a mimetic rite expresses the principles of patriarchy, giving to the male adulthood and its concomitant social and religious and creative privilege, and in so doing identifies the ways and means of civilization, so mephexis has come to be generally regarded as the embodiment of matriarchal principle, the utterance of the group, rather than of the hierarchical one, the primitive as opposed to the civilized, as it has been so defined, whose primary characteristic is totemistic, a sense of emotional solidarity, group oneness, but also a strong sense of difference from other groups, although the parts may once have been a whole in a pre-totemistic organization. That I am attempting to draw here an analogy between the totemistic society with its undifferentiated thinking, its reliance for solidarity on emotional unity and sympathetic ceremony, with its origins and present internecine struggles within the women's movement must be apparent. But I must also go further and insist that, one, the mephectic process, because it does not allow for individual or aesthetic objectification, is both a degrading and self-destructive model for the women's movement to follow, and even more so for the lesbian, since even more than the hierarchical model, it disallows for the individual expression of woman. Further, I believe that it is the insistence on mephectic thinking which has caused a destruction, a serious retardation of gifted feminist and lesbian feminist artists and thinkers, who, while attempting to maintain their emotional ties to the group, to the totem, are simultaneously attempting the mimetic rite of self-expression. Gotta get my breath. Unaccustomed as I am. Thus, these women work unsupported by the patriarchy and are actively resisted by the group, which is even more profoundly threatened by differentiated thinking than by any other thing. Such thinking, thank you. Such thinking is both the death knell of the group and the birth song, the dithyram, of its next stage of development. Hence the murderous weaponry of such accusations as star trip, elitist, male-identified, and anti-feminist. And feminism itself is a word commonly used to represent non-deviant oneness with the group emotion. The accusations are an expression by the group of two great fears. Number one, that the felt continuity of the group as a whole will be interrupted if individual observation rather than collective assessment is permitted. And two, if one member becomes distinct, the rest of the group will become obscure. Such individuals who move from the felt to the thought are no longer permitted participation in or benefits from the emotional intoxication of the group. The member becomes the outcast. She has attempted an imitation of the alien. She might have, for example, attempted art. This woman then operates under a triple burden. By undergoing the second birth of mimesis, she has necessarily had to undergo a previous birth. Her first act of imitation of the alien has been to imitate a man, much in the same way that Pentheus meant to imitate the alien by dressing as a woman to learn the secrets of the woman in the Bacchae. Since she knows she cannot be initiated into power and intelligence unless she does, and then she must undergo the ritual of authentication. She must be tested and proved by those who know that she is not really one of them, but only pretending. At this point, she may be murdered, as was Pentheus by the women. Presuming she survives, she is alone. As I have said, she has transgressed against community. She has declared the existence of a separation between subject and object. Much of the agony is brought about by yet another aspect of the mimetic situation, again, as it is commonly read, in that it demonstrates a separation. Excuse me. No, I must interject something else here. Presently, Mephexis has been called into being as a synonym for revolution, as a synonym for female culture, because of the polarized situation of either or. There has apparently been no other choice, no other models. Take the paralysis of patriarchy, graft oneself to it, or be smothered to death in the embrace of the group. Rebellion, like Mephexis, however, is only a stage of development, not an end in itself. As it begins to make itself into an end and become a mirror image of that which it resists, the woman who really wants to move, to work, to be born, is destroyed. This woman, and we can call her the lesbian artist, has only two choices, and both of them are avenues to destruction. Two death rows, ending again in separate but equal gas chambers, both designed either by intention or by fear of difference to choke the working woman. Much of the agony is brought about by yet another aspect of the mimetic situation, again as it is commonly read, in that it demonstrates the separation between subject of mind and body, thought from feeling, and assigns gender to each. What all of this has to do with the subject of lesbian aesthetics is, I hope, becoming clear. Ideally, the lesbian artist can enact a lifelong role of the kouros, the lovely youth, nearly androgynous in its ability to shift from shape to shape, from gender to gender, yet engaged in initiation by a refusal to participate wholly in the condition identified as womanhood. A refusal to participate in the condition known as womanhood, let me repeat. For womanhood, as the myth demonstrates, is an inadequate vehicle for creativity. And no wonder, within the myth, is the woman denied even her biologically creative status. In truth, she is only the host on whom the parasite feeds. Because of this, I've always been uncomfortable with the movement lesbians' insistence that she is exactly like any other woman, only more so because in the act of love, she becomes woman in duplicate. For the lesbian artist, within the context of controlling myth, this is unsound thinking. For just as it is artificial to try to create the realities of a totemistic society within the structured patriarchy, to insist on the moral supremacy of Amazon Nation while there still exists a White House, it is equally foolish and self-destructive of the lesbian to identify herself for purposes of assimilation with the general condition of womanhood, either as it is maintained in the social norm or as it expresses itself as a movement mephectic principle. For instance, when a slideshow of the menstrual cycle is projected against a wall and is referred to as quote-unquote women's art, because all women menstruate, because menstruation does not require the interference of the intelligence. If it did, we wouldn't. And therefore, of course, does not require the process of the second birth. The lesbian artist will be doing herself a grave disservice if she allows herself to be seduced into this confusion of the biological with the intellectual. As disastrous as the fallacy that to give birth is to make a thing. To call the emotions of the totemistic group art is tantamount to calling the parlor reenactment of catching the big one, of the big one that got away, art. It is of danger equally to both group and individual artist-thinker not to recognize that the work-making process engages necessarily the hierarchical process of mimesis. It is danger not to recognize that the two processes are frequently, at least now, mutually exclusive, and that the artist will suffer outrage from two places if she, like a colossus, forces herself to stand astride two worlds. As I have said, the group will disown her for expressing that stage of development which they either will not or cannot grow to, and the patriarchy will despise her for her effort to become one of them. The abuses of the mimetic enactment are plain to see, that women are explicitly disallowed participation, that it maintains a system of exclusiveness and congealment of privilege, that it is probably the root cause for the antagonism between sense and sensibility, which in turn is the root cause for the disasters of Western civilization. Man looked up from the earth, observed the sun, and the rational Apollo was born. Woman is not mistaken when she tries to make alternatives in which she can bring herself to birth as effectively as man believes he has brought himself to birth. Nor is she mistaken when, having suffered the effects of male civilization, she does not wish to imitate that particular birth process. But she is terribly mistaken if she returns to the pre-mimetic organization with a view to making art. She will only eventually be forced by her own intellectual necessities to repeat that process of historical intellectual progression, or will be forced and die of the conflict to live out two developmental situations simultaneously. But not necessarily the lesbian, nor necessarily the heterosexual woman if she chooses instead the reconstruction of the myth which I propose. And that reconstruction necessitates looking much more closely into the nature of Dionysus and reinterpreting for our own uses the god's functions. The lesbian is neither man nor is she, as I have suggested in terms of the myth, a woman. By virtue of her erotic imagination, she does not naturally share in the common lot of either gender. Like Dionysus, her specifics, unless corrupted, are primarily androgynous. And I would refer you here to an essay in a recent issue of Women's Studies by Dr. Catherine Stimson on the androgyn and the homosexual for some development of that idea. But what the contemporary lesbian mostly does, I fear, is to reassure the women's movement at large that they are almost as good as she is, and in so doing earn her own cozy place within a system of oppression. As I've already suggested, a primary attribute of Dionysus is his close association with the mother, an association so close that the male and female figures eventually blend, and there can be seen as little organic distinction between the female mother and the male son as there can between the earth and the fruits of the earth. Gender identification in that model collapses. Inherent in the religious uses of Dionysus is the figure of Semele, who at the most profound level of the rites, is only another disguise of Dionysus, and exactly the opposite. Dionysus is only another enactment of Semele, speaking in pre-Olympian terms, of course. For as has been demonstrated, the emergence of Dionysus in the state of the Kouros and into the womb of the father is the beginning of patriarchy. But this cancellation of the mother, for all its implied grief for women at large, was essential for the development of differentiated thinking. The mother and the son are not one, and it is an explicit recognition of the fact, once more, that for the woman, for the mother, birth is not a creative act. A new image to represent creative thought had to be made, but it was Dionysus who participated in birth from the womb of the father. And it was essential to the expression of the aesthetic that that son be Dionysus. For with him to the five Zeus, he brought the ecstasy, the intoxicated spirit of the group sacrament, which was female imbued from Semele, from the worship of the Bacchants. The second birth of Dionysus does not make Dionysus male. And it is the mistake of Olympus and of patriarchy to believe this is so. But it is the manipulation of the myth which has canceled the female principle, as it could be represented by the lesbian, from the order of art and work. And it is the mistake of the lesbian worker to take on the mythic identification of womanhood when she could be experiencing a freedom greater than either man or woman's, the freedom of Dionysus, the early reality of his exaltation, which the myth identifies as female, the later reality of intellectual power, which the myth identifies as male, the ultimate symbolism as these two natures merge as genderless, art maker and art giver. And it will be despair for the lesbian to read the myth in any other way. To identify with the totemistic nursing spirit of the matriarchy is to identify with the non-productive and the anti-intellectual, the cradle from which thought is always sent forth in male form. To identify wholly with the male expression of the myth is to deny the ecstatic principle of the female, which Dionysus maintains, which equally with intellect is the wellspring of the art. In Dionysus are inextricably united both magic and the manipulation of magic, the double-edged sanctity, as Jane Ellen Hirston remarks it, of mana and taboo. And to Dionysus, to this expression of the androgynous best of both worlds belongs lesbian artist, to whom no configuration of gender may be assigned. Like Dionysus, the lesbian, the woman as worker par excellence, must be purged of the collective spirit. There must be loss, but it must be loss without the detriment of loss. The group must realize, as do the bacchants and the maenads, that their collective emotion has fostered the essential stuff from which the Godhead will emerge, and delight in their own participation in the formation of the dromana, or things done. And the artist never be deceived by others or by herself that in undergoing the sacred passage of the second birth, that, I'm missing a page, my last page is gone. Okay, I'll improvise. That she is becoming, if she leaves the mother figure, that she is becoming, by contrast, male. That, I guess I'm actually saying that there is the third alternative, and that is Dionysus. I think that's really quite enough of this. Thank you.
Gail Rubin, first speaker. How do these things work? I'm not going to really talk about aesthetics, and I'm not going to talk about the Greeks. But you can't get away from them. I'm going to talk about what essentially was a kind of Greek revival, only it took place in France. It was a revival by a group of lesbians who flourished along the banks of the Seine from about 1895 until approximately a few years ago. Can you hear me? I'm not used to microphones. I don't know how they work. Like Mick Jagger, the microphone. I mainly want to talk about them in part because I don't know anything about aesthetics. something of a mistake to be on this panel. But also because I feel like they have to be reclaimed before the vulture of straight culture picks their bones, assimilates their experiences, and deforms the lessons of their lives. They're all now dead or almost dead, and the secrets of half a century are being reviewed in the New York Times by such luminaries as Anais Nin. Their stories are being written by straight biographies. One of the most recent is Between Me and Life, the one of Romaine Brooks by Merle Seacrest. Some of them are in process. There are two in process on Natalie Barney, which I haven't seen yet. They're good biographies in the sense that they provide a lot of information about these people, and we can use the information as we see fit, but they seem to me obscene, partly because a certain hobby of mine is becoming public domain. That's one reason it's obscene. But the other is that the lives of our heroines are being recorded by people who haven't the faintest notion of what these women lived for. We can find out what they did from the straight biographies, but the significance of what they did is obscured by facile moralizing, idiot psychoanalysis, lack of comprehension, and a kind of straight knee-jerk reflex that they would be better served by excusing or belittling the lesbianism of which they were so inordinately proud. I don't know, I could pick out examples from the Brooks biography, but she talks about Romaine Brooks coming out at this girls' school and talks about how, you know, every girl goes through this ordinary period of homosexuality, but at some point she discovers boys. And some women, however, just never discovered boys. And it's really awful to read this stuff. I just feel like we have to raise monuments to our own dead before they're enshrined in the carefully whitewashed tombs which the straight world is in such a hurry to build for them. By them, I mean Natalie Barney, Renee Vivien, and a small subculture of which they were a part, which has been described as a coterie of charming and talented young ladies who preferred their own company to that of men. It was once said of Barney that she knows nothing, reads nothing, and divines everything, this wild girl from Cincinnati. She wasn't really from Cincinnati. She was born in Dayton, and her family was very wealthy. They kind of shuttled around between Dayton and Bar Harbor, Maine, and France. She once said of herself, "If my studies have come to nothing, it is because my only books were women's looks." I would maintain that in some... very important sense, she was really the mother of us all and the first real lesbian liberations. Well, she and Renee Vivien. Barney's family traveled in Europe a lot, and Natalie was educated at a girls' finishing school near Paris. It was called Les Ruches. If you've read Olivia by Dorothy Strachey, you've read of the school. It's the same school. It was a lesbian hotbed. The two women who ran it were lesbian refugees from the city of Paris. But Natalie Barney did not find out about lesbianism at Les Ruches. She knew about it. Yes, Eleanor Roosevelt went there, and Gore Vidal. Bertha reminded me last year, Gore Vidal was reviewing this. What is it, Eleanor and Franklin, in the New York Review of Books, and he made a very snide comment about the school, which you only could know if you knew about Olivia and Dorothy Strachey. Sort of maligning Eleanor. By association. Natalie did not learn about lesbianism there. She has very moving soliloquies about how she discovered it when she was 8. And once she knew of it, she was a woman of such single-minded intention. She then set up her entire life in such a way that she could live her lesbianism to the fullest. That's why she went to France. She lived in France. There's a book which I'll return to in a minute called Idyl Saphique, which is a fictional account of her first affair in Paris, or one of her first affairs, one of her most celebrated early affairs in Paris, in which she's asked why she came to Paris, and the writing is not her own, it's her words through Léon de Pougy, who wrote the book, but she talks about how she simply had to come to a culture where she could be a dyke in peace. She couldn't do it in America. And one thing about France, there are two things that were, I'm not really sure why all this took place in France, I've been speculating on it for years, but there are two things. One was the Code Napoleon, which had legalized homosexuality, when was something like 1895, 1904, I don't remember when it was enacted, and the other was a long tradition in French culture in which lesbianism was, it was there, it was spoken about. The lesbian was a kind of character and all sorts of symbolist romantic documents, usually as a kind of monster, but there was in some of the poetry, there was a French, this is part of the French tradition of the celebration of the erotic, and the erotic to a long tradition in France does not have to do with procreation, has to do with irrational passion, and the lesbian became a kind of image of the quintessence of this sort of non-biological, non-procreative, thoroughly erotic passion. And she parades through half a dozen books like this. Baudelaire wanted to call Les Fleurs du Mal Les Lesbiennes, and was prevented by his publisher. There's another one by Alfred de Musset. It's a pornographic. It's called Gamiani. And Gamiani says she's a wealthy dyke, and she says, "I am the killing love itself." In any event, back to Barney. She got to Paris. Her mother deposited her there to have her portrait painted by Whistler, and she skipped the artist and lavished all the money on women, mainly buying flowers for Léon de Pougy. Léon de Pougy was a courtesan, the toast of Paris. She and another woman, La Belle Otero, they were rivals for the affections of the man of Paris, and they were very celebrated. Natalie Barney saw Léon de Pougy riding in the woods and fell in love with her. She then knocked on her door with an armload of flowers, dressed as a page, and said, "Léon, let me be your page. I'm in love with you." Now, Pougy described the affair in Idyl Saphique, and describes a sort of has very good descriptions of who Barney was. Now, the trouble with Edil Safik is that they never go to bed. And the novel is a classic encounter between a straight tease and a dyke in love. And every time Barney convinces Leon de Pougy that she really does love her, which Pougy really obviously does want to go to bed with her, it's clear from the novel, something happens. Either one of Barney's old lovers comes and commits suicide at their feet, or because Barney has left her, or Pougy gets sick, or something happens. They never do go to bed. Actually, they were evidently lovers. One thing that Barney never did was that she never confined her affections to other lesbians. She was something of an erotic missionary, and she felt like it would it would be inappropriate to let anything limit her desires, and so she always did exactly what she pleased. She dropped Pougy when she met another expatriate like herself, Pauline Tarn, whose pen name was Renée Vivien. Vivien became the greatest lesbian poet since Sappho, and Barney became the high priestess and missionary of what she described as a religion of the body, of which kisses are the prayers. Vivien was a better writer, I think, but Natalie really knew how to live. Vivien's writing and Barney's life are very artistically executed monuments to the lesbian spirit. They met around 1898 and embarked on a very tempestuous affair in which their sort of inarticulate ideas about who they were and what they were became very articulate, and they formed an ideology of feminism, gay liberation, and a lot of other things. This all occurred around 1900, and Barney kept saying the same things and developing her ideas until she died, which was in 1972. Vivien died in 1909. When they met, they called themselves Young Girls of the Society of the Future. They went to Mytilene, which is the island of Lesbos, to found a colony of women poets in honor of Sappho. This is the Greek Revival. Vivien learned to read Greek because she wanted to read Sappho in the original, and she ended up by translating all the works of Sappho and many other Greek women poets into French. They wrote polemics defending Sapphic love. They wrote poems celebrating it. They produced plays about it. They rewrote dozens of lesbian classics to show lesbianism in its true good light, and they camped around Paris with incredible audacious skill. I'm sorry I don't have slides, and I'm sorry I don't have some pictures. I have some pictures, but not some of the best ones. But one of the best ones, which must date from about 1901 or pre-1901, Barney and Vivien she's sitting down in a long white dress, and Renée is dressed up in a black velvet page boy suit with the letters NCB, Barney's initials, emblazoned across the chest. They broke up in 1901. Now, the breakup is, or is it called the rupture? A lot of ink has been spilled in books some of which are very obscure about whose fault it was, and they each wrote their own version of it, and all the usual recriminations. Renée Vivien's version was Une femme apparue. You'll have to forgive my French. I can read it, but I can't really pronounce it. In which she says that, she was madly in love with Natalie from the day that she met her, and Natalie simply did not love her back. And Natalie Barney wrote a book, Je me souviens, which says that she was madly in love with Renée from the day she met her, and Renée simply did not love her back. The usual version... if you've read Jeanette Foster's Sex Variant Women in Literature, there is a version of the affair. It's based entirely on a book by André Germain, the name of which I forget, which is based entirely on Renée Vivien's version, Une femme apparue, and it's extremely one-sided. The usual story is that Barney simply was too wild and left Vivien because she had to have too many other women, and she killed Vivien. It's very anti-Barney. I don't think it's fair. Natalie was something of an elemental force. It simply could not be contained. It's true. She was also very unfair to her lover. She had what was called a harem. I mean, she was never very monogamous. And one of her lovers with Dorothy Wilde was Dorothy Wilde, Oscar Wilde's niece. And Dorothy Wilde, there's a book called In Memory of Dorothy Wilde, which Barney put together after Dorothy's death. in which there are a number of letters written to a love, who happened to be Barney, and Dorothy talks about how unhappy she was whenever Romaine Brooks or Elizabeth de Grammont would come around, who were other lovers of Barney's. Nevertheless, she stuck with her and did love her very much, and says that. It's a very moving book. However, she had a one-night fling, and Barney hit the roof. Now, on the other hand, Vivienne was something of a mystic and had a big problem. She tended to confuse death and love. And part of this, the history is very unclear. Vivienne kind of divided the lesbian universe into two images. One was Barney, who was represented as Laura Lee in one of the books. The other is Ione, who represents a friend of hers, Violet Shaletto. It's either Shalette or Shaletto, who was a kind of mystic, Christian, chaste, sisterly image. And when Vivienne and Barney were first together, Violet was dying, and she wrote to Vivienne to come and see her, and Vivienne was so enthralled by Barney that she didn't go, and Violet died, and Vivienne spent much of the rest of her life in guilt and suffering over not having gone to the bed of her dying friend, and she blamed the carnality of Barney for keeping her from it.